Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
We're really lucky today to have David Bellamy with us here from Stone Point Partners, the name of his business, who is a renowned expert on the topic. And we'll kick off by getting David just to give us a little bit of on his personal background, how he's got to the illustrious position he's in today, and then we'll go into the topic. But as I say, any point, questions, do raise them. We're not worried which direction the conversation goes, as long as it's roughly business focused, because that's what it's about. It's all for you guys here. And yes, do come in at the back, all that sort of stuff. I'll be doing that. David, over to you.
Thank you. So, I guess, by way of a little bit of background, I studied here, actually, 20-plus years ago. But I've been a consultant, management consultant now for the last 17 years or so. And in that time, I've worked with a whole host of different organisations on a different bunch of topics, from IT to outsourcing to strategy, and then launched, having run another management consulting business, I launched Stone Point & Partners about 6 years ago. About 3 years ago, I had a bit of an epiphany, and that was that for so many years in my career, I've been treating symptoms inside organisations of what was going wrong, and organisations are desperately trying to be competitive and to lead their markets or to do better things. And as an organisation, we got stuck into that. And one of the key components of that subject is happiness at work. And I think the starting point really for us is that maybe I'll start with a question, actually.
Yeah.
What does happiness at work mean to you? Anyone want to have a go at that? What do you think of when I say happiness at work?
What immediately came into your mind then?
Colleagues, the culture, getting paid on time.
Okay.
Type of colleagues you've got, culture of the business,
yeah.
Getting paid on time.
I think there are three levels there. There's the day-to-day, so making sure you're comfortable at your desk and all that sort of thing and your working hours.
Yep.
Then there's the strategic thing, as you say, the sort of culture of the company. And then perhaps things like how do they fix things when they go wrong? Like if you're not paid on time, how well do they do it? That sort of thing, if it's done well, will help your happiness.
So dealing with sort of crises or hiccups in business performance or something like that.
Also maybe valued as an employee, promotion opportunities, understanding what your job description is, keeping it clear. Those sort of things are important in a job, to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I'm just repeating this for the radio listeners. Help me now.
Being valued as an employee.
Being valued as an employee and just feeling good and great opportunities and promotion opportunities.
Yeah, understanding your role was a part of that as well, wasn't it? And then great responses. Because I think the thing that stops many organisations in my experience of really embracing the idea of happier employees and focusing on that as an outcome is that we've drifted into some business language around things like employee engagement. So it was employee satisfaction, it then became employee engagement. And many of the ways that we approach this inside companies make it quite transactional. So what we do is we make engagement with the company conditional on its strategic performance. Well, so what the typical approach to engaging employees and therefore getting the best out of them, this is an idea that what we do is we leaders go away and they think up vision and they talk about where we're going to go in the next 20 years or so, or 10 years, depends on which model that they choose to follow. But and then we use internal marketing techniques to try to entice people. But you're selling it internally to staff. And it is interesting that everything we know about productivity, about happiness, about motivation, about what really fires us up as human beings, is that it works the other way around. Actually, if we focus on, and this is what we try and have organisations do, if we focus on creating the conditions in which people feel happier, then we get better results as a return. So, you know, and that means you try to think about things like, you know, so there are five things we talk about, Stephen, that are fundamental to happiness at work. So the first is purpose and meaning. So that is that an organisation stands for something that matters. You know, mission statements fall into that bracket, but of course we know that they've become marketing tools and they adorn the walls of offices and they're used in corporate literature. What we need is an enduring purpose, so something that an organisation truly stands for and values that are commensurate. And once we get that, so organisations understand that, not very good at expressing what their purpose is, but we also need to make that, to relate that to meaning, so that my job, to exactly the point that you made before, that I'm valued part of that, that my contribution is clear in helping the organisation to fulfil its purpose.
What would be, how am I going to like truly buy into that as an employee, as opposed to having a cynical view that everybody says that, because they all have to say the same thing?
Well, I think there's no easy answer to that, but there are a couple of things I would say. So firstly, even the language buy-in implies we're selling something to somebody. So I want you to buy into my version of company. When we create purpose, so purpose needs to address, you know, we always talk to companies, so strategy, as McKinsey would define it, and most textbooks would define it, you know, mission, vision, values, that sort of hierarchy. But when we talk about, so we change all that language, and we talk about purpose. So when we talk about purpose, we're trying to encourage an organisation to imagine, why is it really here? And imagine, we put them through an exercise that is about etching this purpose into the stone front of their building or onto a sort of plinth outside. And it'll be there for 50 to 100 years. So this is no longer about, this is not strategy related, other than in the biggest possible sense. So this is why we exist. And it might include things about, it should include customers, it should include employees, it should include the environment. But it doesn't have to be an essay.
No.
What follows is meaning it, because you know, being a purposeful organisation, or led with purpose, or any other which way you wish to describe it, takes fulfilment of action that matches words. So values, one of the things we see an awful lot inside organisations is people don't really understand values. Staff get them, by the way, in every company we go and talk to. Everybody in the company can tell us what the values are because they're printed on mouse mats and mugs and in the tea room. You talk to executives and they're much less clear about them, and that's because, again, they've been created as a marketing vehicle or as a control tool, and what they really need to be is an intrinsic set of promises inside the firm that matter. You know, this is our purpose, this is what we, you know, this is why we exist, and this is what we stand for. So those two things, you know, sort of fall in the bracket of purpose and meaning. The second thing is, we have to excuse these expressions, and we try to make them descriptive, but collectively authentic leadership, or collectively authentic leaders. And that's because authentic leadership is not a concept that we've invented. It's all about leadership being true to itself, but it's something that I've observed in particular. We see authenticity seems to arrive with position. And the collective part of authenticity really is about saying that what we need to see inside firms and what makes us happier is knowing that the people in this company are stewards of the organisation. They think company first and they think employees first before they think about themselves. And we see too often, you know, evidence that power tends to corrupt. You know, and you know, the idea that actually the rules don't apply to us at the top of an organisation. And yet there are lots of leaders out there trying very hard, but again, it's about congruence with, you know, put the company first. I think Jim Collins put it best with that level five leadership, you know, that idea of people who grew up in the business truly understood every aspect of it, cared more about the company than they do themselves. And these are the things that make us feel better about work, when you're looking up and you know the guys up who are steering the ship. Care deeply about everybody in it.
Do you think there's more of that in, say, like a family business? Yeah, even a big, so for example, I'm the director of a non-executive of a business that's something like 200 years old, the seventh generation now, which is a car dealership and agricultural equipment and all that sort of thing down in Kent. And the current MD is about late 40s or something, and he's got about 300 employees, something like that. And it's not a particularly profitable business. It's okay, but it's not particularly profitable. He could have a far easier life if he just sold the business and, you know, put the money in the bank or whatever and just did nothing. And I ask him, well, why do you do it? Why do you carry on doing it? And part of it is because he's got, like, his ancestors looking over his shoulder. But the other thing is, I care about my employees, these 300 employees. I think, wouldn't quite say my family, but it's not that sort of trite, but you know, there's a genuine patriarchal caring there, which sort of, you know, which I think the employees definitely see and appreciate. But he owns the business, and he's, you know, he's taken it on from his father and all that sort of thing. In a different organisation, inevitably in bigger ones, there isn't that family connection.
And I think it's a brilliant question, actually, because there's an organisation called Tomorrow's Company, and I think it's them. It could be, Tomorrow's Company. And this is an organisation that's looking now at corporate governance. And what?
Not from a Society of Arts and Commerce.
Could be, yes. I think it is. But it's looking at corporate governance. So what drives behaviour of companies? And one of the things that they've observed is that when you look at the way organisations used to be formed and used to be run, whether they were family or Quaker oriented, you know, they people saw the leadership position as one of stewardship. So I am holding on to the reins for a period of time, and I need to pass it on, and I need to pass it on preferably in a better shape than when I picked it up. Most modern companies don't have that. So smaller companies, family-owned businesses, still retain that sort of mindset, and you just expressed it brilliantly. If I'm a PLC and I'm a chief executive, then I've got quarterly results to produce.
Yep.
And that means my quarter needs to be better than the last one, or I need to be able to explain it.
And indeed, you generally don't even know who your shareholders are.
No,
people
quite.
Actually own the company, who obviously can change from day to day. So I can sell my shares to you, and you can sell them to...
And they will know. They will know the major institutional investors, because a huge amount of a CEO's job is looking after that population now. But you know, the point's absolutely valid. You know that it's changing. The needs of the shareholders in today's society are very different than they used to be. And so the things that prudence and longevity and sustainability are less meaningful when actually it is within. You know, it was written in the articles of incorporation in most companies that the job is to serve the shareholders. And so these conflicts exist, you know. So what we're noticing is the slight flaws in the way that governance works in companies that leave us with a lack of conscience. So the person who might be sitting on the shoulder in the example that you gave, the ancestors looking down and saying, keep the tradition going, keep the business moving forward, son, is missing for most major firms. So that's a big factor.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School, in partnership with Radiolab.
Is there a danger of management putting the brand, the image of the organisation, ahead of caring for the employees and the employees' best interests?
Okay. My first instinct is to say that doesn't sound like a great company to work for. There is absolutely a danger, and there are lots of things in. You probably see this more than I do if you're studying business right now. But many of the management systems that we've developed were developed for a period that is long since gone. One of those things which you just described is that all thinking is done upstairs and all doing is done downstairs. You know, and. And yet the companies we admire right now don't do that. But my question would be to an organisation that places its brand above its people, is who do they think delivers it? You know, actually what a brand promises, or what, you know, that's experienced by other people. It's developed in a marketing office, isn't it, somewhere, or, you know, in the boardroom, and it's delivered by the people who work there. we use an expression, and this is our company's strapline, which is world-class companies don't just happen. They're created by the people who work there. And the point of that is, of course, it is not just about the people who determine that, you know, this is the direction we should take and everybody else just must get us there. So there's an absolute danger. But again, when we come back to the sort of points I was making before, it doesn't feel to me like an organisation that has, you know, a great set of leadership. But it is a nice segue if I might go on to talk about management practices, because I've just touched on it there. We talk about humanistic management as the sort of third leg of our five drivers of happiness, and humanistic management is something that I guess for everybody probably matters. We were talking before this recording about you know, sort of the mock tribunal you were doing and flexible working, and of course, you know, what springs to mind is that we create in organisations policies and rules, and policies and rules are created in order to control people, and yet what we really want them to do is be able to do the job that we pay them to do in the best possible way. And so being human about that and recognising that actually we created policies and therefore we can change policies because that's the way that we should be looking after our people is, you know, is one example. But the management pressure, you know, pressure creates diamonds is the old adage, isn't it? But it absolutely doesn't in business sense. You know, one of the analogies I use here, well, there are two I talk about with sort of humanistic management. One is, I've got an 11-month-old daughter, and the only thing kids, babies of that age can control is what they put in their mouths. And of course, what we want them to do is feed. We want them to eat. Now, you put pressure on a child about food, and what we see is the same as in human beings, you know, in adults at work, which is that all of their instincts become stressed. And what we do in stress is we start to think about other things, which is we freeze, and then our stomach wants to shrink because we're getting ready to do some other stuff, you know. And so children don't eat when you put pressure on them. And I think it's one of those wonderful sort of examples of what happens when you put pressure on people at work. I will tell a little story, if I might, just because I did this at a leadership talk I did last year, where it was the early part of my career. I was in a major international consulting firm, and I rattled through the ranks, which was brilliant. I had a great period where I was promoted every year. And then I got made the boss of a division. And six people resigned in protest. And it was fabulous. So I'd had, you know, 5 years of continued growth. The organisation kept rewarding me and saying, you're doing a great job. And then when I got the job I'd been chasing, the people around me said, I'm not working for him. And it was a lovely lesson, you know, because it sort of really opened your eyes to, well, opened my eyes. It was a painful way to see it, but a real way to appreciate that just constantly applying pressure to people, and then the idea that I was going to be in charge of more of them, I think must have been terrifying for them. So pressure, it one example. The other humanistic management example I talk about is one of my favourite hobby horses at the moment, which is the performance review. And so the dehumanising process that we go through with every company, where we feel that we need to sit down annually and...
I was going to say, it might be worth just explaining what for those who haven't started work yet.
Yeah, of course.
What a pleasurable experience the performance review is, and what it is.
Well, so the performance review, again, it's one of those habits that most firms, we're going to call it a habit because it's one that doesn't seem to have much value for organisations these days, but it is the process where you sit down with your manager on an annual basis and you talk about the things that you were going to do in the year gone by, and you talk about the things that you will be expected to do in the future, and normally an evaluation of your proximity to promotion or anything else. And at the end of it, there's normally a score allocated to your performance and a percentage pay rise or similar attached to it.
There's
responsibility and the rung of the ladder without the actual money.
Without the extra money. That's right, you know, of course. But the process is a peculiar one because we know going into it, you know, every manager will tell you that the amount of effort that goes in it, you know, to determine where they're going to spend the finite pot that they've been given to distribute amongst their staff means that they know the result going in, and therefore the rest of the conversation is phony. You know, that we know that managers find it incredibly dehumanising for themselves to have to grade their staff. They could have done a fabulous job, but actually you can only have three that get a one, and you can only have four that get a two, and six have got to get a three. And that, to this, demoralising in a really substantial way for people. So that process, my challenge to most people that I talk to in this capacity in my day job is, imagine having that conversation at home with your partner at the end of every year. How did you do this year? What do I expect you to do next year? You know, it doesn't happen that way, because we actually have far more natural conversations about, you know, what we're expected to do that feels more normal. And so we talk about, you know, it being a much better thing to do to have obsession with feedback inside companies. You know, again, it seems to be that I'm the boss, therefore I'm cleverer, whereas what we really need to be doing inside organisations is sharing the questions that we need to address and creating collective responsibility for them, you know, so that the manager to employee relationship becomes one of coaching, you know, and it becomes about how do we create a better team environment, and you know, that sort of level.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
How do you? Because I've been exactly through the process you just described, where you know, I had X people working for me, and simplistically, I thought they're all great, and one or two were okay. But none were terrible. Whereas the direction from the HR department or whatever would be, like you say, you've got to allocate 20% have got to be great, and 50% have got to be average, and so many have got to be below average or whatever. Things like that, which is just like stupid. And but I suppose so the question is, like you say, I've got to divvy out the 3% or whatever it is that I've got in terms of potential salary increases across my staff. Am I becoming aware of how good or bad they are over the sort of the last 12 months since the previous review point or the salary adjustment point or something? Or is there something that's got to come out of these sort of like, not got to come out, that will come out of these sort of coaching, mentoring sessions?
So there are, yeah, there are a number of...
So the trouble is, most organisations need to have, like you say, some rules, some formalities to them for all sorts of reasons. But what you're talking about is sort of like making it much more... coming to be,
is
it pejorative, more willy, more flexible?
So I disagree with the word willy and agree with flexible. So I think the question you're politely not asking is, all right, so you've phrased the problem, what's the solution, and then what do you replace it with? Let's say that on. So I think you're right, there are some things that you have to replace. My belief is we have to think about... human beings at this point, you know, and would we rather have a more grown-up conversation where I'm having a conversation with my boss every week, every month, whatever it is, that I sort of understand what's going on, I understand where I am and how I'm doing, and when we get to the I'm not suggesting there is no conversation that takes place about pay review, I'm not sure we just need to wrap it up with the processes that we do that seem to be about sandwiching it somewhat. You know, if we give... So rules that are created about evenly distributing money in a particular way are rules, and they don't, you know, if you want to move to a different model, then actually create the space in which you allow your manager to do that. So create the autonomy for them, so here is the pot of money, you can distribute it amongst your team as you see fit. You know, and it's...
Or you could even go back and say, well, actually, I don't want to allow the HR department to be saying it's 3% of all the finance department, so it's 3% this year. What we need to be doing in the organisation is talking about how much how much do we think we that our employees deserve merit or whatever, and if we want to want to make that 5, 6, 7, 10%, where do we find the money to do that through cutting some other things or through doing something fantastic to improve sales or whatever whatever it might be.
Yep.
So the starting point is probably wrong.
Well, this is exactly right. I think you framed it, and you've done that brilliantly, actually. So reframing the question. It's precisely that there's, I don't know if anybody has been observing some Swedish experiments lately about working hours. Have you come across the six-hour day?
Mm. Oh, I've heard about it.
So a few of you have. The premise here is, what happens to our performance as an organisation? What happens to productivity if we reduce the working day to 6 hours? And there are some quite strict rules about some aspects of this. So it is 8:30 to 11:30 in the morning, and an enforced hour break, and then 12:30 to 3:30. And the organisations participating in this experiment have been saying that you know, what they really want to happen, or they've been asking that there are no distractions. So please don't use social media. Please don't, you know, do your work for 3 hours and be as good as you can. And there's been a lot of benefits. There's been some really interesting results. So organisations have been forced to look at some of their processes. You know, so if I want, so weekly meetings, for example, team meetings, that last an hour, down to 8 minutes. Without losing anything that was important, you know, and so organisations are doing interesting things like standing up for those conversations rather than sit down and make them formal, and people are getting home at 3:30 and they're there in time for kids coming home from school, and you know, so really interesting things. And other departments are saying, actually, do you know what, doesn't work for us, but like any great experiment, you know, the firms are learning things about what they're able to do in a particular amount of time. And so if we've only got 2 hours in an afternoon to do X, how can we change the process rather than just living with what we've got in order to enable us to do that and be out at 3:30? And it's, you know, so it's a build on the point you were making before, but it is absolutely about exploring the context of what we're trying to achieve and perhaps reframing the question and then approaching it differently. But there's so much intelligence, knowledge and experience inside companies to do this stuff that, you know, that the top-down mindset and the rigorous structures that generally come with complexity and size, don't get me wrong, I know it's harder in big firms, but it is not beyond the wit of man, you know, to do this stuff. Shall I talk about the fourth thing?
Yeah.
We've touched on some of these things, you'll notice that they overlap. Connected autonomy. So we see all the time a real distance between what leadership think and what the staff think. So, expressions of what a culture really is and what it isn't. You know, but what comes out of that fundamentally is that most people who go to work to do a great job. And the people who understand most about what customers experience are the people who serve them. And so we have this expression we use to our clients, and it's, you know, cascade the question, not the answer. And it's back to that leadership thing, which is you don't have to develop all the solutions upstairs. Determine the direction, determine the major measures that we need to, or the, you know, we talk about, you know, really macro KPIs. So what are the things, if we need revenue to go up or profits to increase or costs to reduce, then let's set the frame for that and then invite the organisation and the staff to tackle it. And so the connected autonomy point is give me some responsibility and some control over what influences me. You know, so my working day, my environment, the way I do my job, give me more control over those things. And when I have more control over those things, I can do them better. And if I can do them quicker, then brilliant. You know, make my job outcomes oriented. Don't make it about sitting down and follow, you know, slavishly the processes.
Yeah.
And you know what? Every one of us experiences this. Every time you pick up the phone to any call center, you know, you can hear the frustration on, you know, I've got to take you through security questions. You know who I am. And you know, all that sort of stuff that we know is driven from other places. But the autonomy point is saying, let me have some control. And staff are always saying to us, and there's one great example. We worked with a big insurance company probably 18 months ago now. And some of the leadership team in this firm were saying, the staff just don't care. You know, they're not they're not that interested. They just come to work to pay to earn money, and it's one of the biggest fallacies in business, I think, that people come to work. You know, yes, you want to get paid, and you want to get paid a fair wage, but it's not why you go to work, unless everything else is terrible. So the leadership are saying that the staff aren't that interested, so let's just make some changes. And the staff were saying, we know that there's some big pressure, and we know that there's some stuff going on upstairs. But if they could only give us, you know, we got some really great ideas. We know how to make things better here. Mm. And that's brilliant, because you realise, again, when we're able to bridge that gap, that you realise that actually right through the organisation that the people let us control our own destiny. And so that connected autonomy, it's not about working in isolation. It's about working with control over what influences me and my team and the people around us, my friends, in the context of something bigger.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
I've got an example of that. I used to work for Tesco for a long time, mainly on the finance side. But in the late 80s, early 90s, so quite a while ago now, supermarkets in general were much less customer service focused than perhaps they are now. And Tesco was very poor from that point of view, and had picked that, and we knew it, and we wanted to do something about it, make it a better place for people to shop. And we had a great, customer service initiative. It's all about the checkouts, and that's where most contact is with the customer, obviously, and all of that sort of thing. And so all the checkout staff were given a number of instructions as to what to do when the next customer comes through the checkout. So they could make eye contact, say good morning sir or good morning madam or whatever, and do X, Y and Z, and then when you sort of take the money, say something or other and have a nice day, or it wasn't have a nice day, but something like that anyway at the end. And all of us from sort of head office, etc., would go around and do mystery shopper trips to check and score shops on this performance random exercise. And we did it, and the feedback from customers was pretty negligible difference. They weren't specifically asked about the questions, but what do you think about customer service, etc. And like you were saying, David, there was no input from the checkout staff into this whole exercise. So 2-3 years later, we do it again, but we do it differently. And this time there has been engagement with the checkout staff and so on. And what are your frustrations as a checkout operator? It's the 28 things I have to press a button for and ask for a supervisor to come and check that I can give a 10 pence refund on. All the things like that. Various things. And I just want to, what didn't you like about the other customer services? I don't speak like that. I say, you're right, love. Or, hiya. Or all that sort of thing. I don't say good morning, sir. Or good morning. I just want to behave naturally, like I do with my friends. Right. And that was it. That was the new initiative. Just treat the customers like you treat your friends. And by the way, we've taken away 21 of the 28 things that you have to get a supervisor for. And sure enough, customer service rankings went up significantly, as well as productivity. Customers actually got through the checkouts more quickly because they didn't have to keep being interrupted to get a supervisor and all that sort of thing. This is exactly the example.
Yeah. It's a good one, a really good one.
Right, and what's your...
The last one is developmental growth. I always use the Richard Branson quote associated with this, and that's that, train people so that they can leave, and then treat them well enough that they don't want to. And I think that most of us want to grow, don't we? We want to be better human beings as we go through our lives, and that sort of happens naturally. But when our organisations, when the companies that we work with, work for, I should say, make that happen for us, it just generally makes us feel better. You know, you go on training courses, you get invested in, you learn some things about yourself, you learn some things about your job. You know, and one of the, you know, back to this purpose point that we started with, our individual purpose, the reason that we exist, one of the strongest drivers, and this is Maslow's peak of his pyramid, isn't it? The self-actualization bit, being the very best I can be, is this drive towards mastery. You know, and so for organizations, creating opportunities for people to move into streams of specialism, if that's the right thing for them, you know, perhaps recognizing the difference between technical expertise and management expertise, because they are very different, you know, rather than just promoting your best performers into management positions, actually make them the experts in the product, make them the expert in sales, make them the expert, you know, and then let people who care about other people, you know, who score differently in other dimensions, look after the people. But that sense inside organisations that they care deeply about developing everybody in it, becoming better, and you know, there are lots of people out there that talk about learning organisations, and you know, therefore, you know, where you're creating whole businesses that care deeply about becoming the best at what they do, and that means exploring every aspect. And this is, you know, when we look at, if you ever watch a recruitment video for Apple, we use one with clients actually, because it's a great way of just expressing the way that they think about things. You know, you recognize the level of investment in their people. I mean, they start with great people, don't get me wrong, you know, and you have to fit to join. But you get the sense of this drive towards mastery. You know, that they want to be absolutely the best at everything they can do, and then they create the conditions in which people can actually do that. And so that sort of sense inside firms that there is a path, I just dropped my mic, sorry, that there is a path to personal improvement that improves my career, that improves my prospects, that improves my standing in, you know, whatever capacity we choose to view that, is incredibly important. So, yeah, I mean, those are the five things. And it's interesting, you know, you may have noticed that we haven't talked about money, we haven't talked about, we haven't talked about the workplace, and we probably do include that in what we do. You know, having the workplace be an environment that you can make these things happen. In, you know.
Interesting, what we haven't talked about also is, what does the business actually make or sell or do? So, and we were talking before the session started. Slightly earlier in my career, having qualified as an accountant, my first job in industry was in the retail division, UK retail division of British American Tobacco, who, as you probably know, make cigarettes and sell billions of them around the world, making lots of people ultimately die. And I went on a management development course when I was in a company for people from all around the world, and I was saying to David that it was like a 3-week course at some sort of country house type thing, and you used to come down each morning to your little pigeonhole, pick up an email or whatever it was that was with the course, and they would always leave you some cigarettes and cigars. You know, I didn't smoke, and I think probably less than half of us smoked. But I have to hold my hand up. I didn't really, well, I stayed working for an organisation that, you know, made and sold tobacco products. I wasn't directly involved, it was in the retail division of it. So does that matter? I mean, hands up here, anybody who fancies a career working for an arms manufacturer?
Mm. That was my first job. I used to work for a company that made a wide range of things. It made motors and rotors for military aircraft and tanks. It wasn't actually weapons and ordnance, but it was definitely in that element. And there was a moral question: do I really want to be working for a company that...
Yeah, I'll just repeat that point. So one of the guys here, his first job was in a business that was in the sort of military field. And you weren't quite sure whether you wanted to do it. Not moral, but possibly it was like needs must. Mm. You know, I've got to pay my rent and all of that sort of thing. So how does that because you could work for a tobacco business or a military business, and they could treat their employees fantastically. Mm. They probably do. But how does that affect my happiness?
Well, you know, I suspect it will, you know, vary on a case by case basis. But what we know is, and it's right back to that organisational purpose thing that we started with.
Yeah.
That we know enough about what drives us as human beings. That purpose. I'm going to let myself down. I not remember who's from this, but there's one major global firm that includes just trying to do no harm, as part of their activity, in their purpose, in their mission statement. And I think it's Shell that has part of its mission to replace what they take. And so this idea that, you know, we understand that, and particularly this next generation or this current generation of graduates, people coming into the workplace, seem to care more deeply about connection with purpose and their own values than we probably ever noticed before. So it does matter. I think, you know, I think we need to probably create some space for people who have little choice, you know, and that whilst cigarettes and arms manufacturing are not illegal activities, you know, I probably wouldn't place any moral judgment on people who choose to work there, all those companies in their activities, but if, you know, even in that space, if you think that they're competing against other firms manufacturing similar products in similar ways, and when it boils down to it, that, you know, an organisation being better than another organisation will be determined by the power of its culture, by the nature of its employees, by how much they can, you know, how much productivity they can achieve, and all of the stuff we've talked about today. This, you know, the thing I ought to have said I haven't so far is, why would they bother? You know, why? So we talk about happiness. You know, we've talked about lots of things in which we know. You know, all of us will know that you know, working in a company that does all the things that we've talked about in this session feels better than working in another environment that perhaps doesn't. But to the leaders of these companies, what we talk about is, why would they bother? Productivity. 20 to 30% increase when we're happier over regular levels of happiness, and you know, when you think about company performance, that's staggering. Mm. I was with the CEO of an organisation just 3 weeks ago, and he's spending hundreds of millions on technology. And I'd said to him that, you know, if we could unlock 20 to 30% productivity by changing the way that people feel and behave inside an organisation, and, you know, he accepted that he would take my right arm off for that. You know, it shows how hard it is to get, but it exists there. We are more creative. We're more innovative. You know, these are the buzzwords. If you read any management books or any management articles at the moment, people are striving after innovation and creativity inside the firms. And actually, all the things we've talked about on the negative side of the conversation today stifle those things.
Yeah.
When we're happier and we create the right team environments and we are more human at work, then we actually encourage it. And that's better. The employees who are happier are more loyal. They stick around longer. They have dramatically fewer, I think it's about eight sick days fewer a year on average.
Right.
And you put that, you know, that people aren't off for months on end, are they? But, you know, so, you know, and so that pretty much every KPI that the organisations tend to track improve when we place emphasis on happiness over engagement, you know, over the other things.
Business Matters. Brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
All right, I think we're almost going to wind up now, but I just wanted to see if there are any last questions from our audience today.
I've got a couple of questions related to performance reviews. One was like a question, the other one is what do you think of the suggestion? When you talk about the HR department saying there's going to be 2% in the top flight and 5% this, that, and the other, if you get an employee that sort of misses out on the top 2 or 3 years running, is there a danger that it will disengage them? It will make them, give them less of an incentive? I'm also thinking, well, I've tried hard, I've missed out 3 times, why bother? So is there a danger of actually disengagement?
Just repeat that question. So the question is regarding performance reviews, if an employee misses out several years running on the highest rate of pay increase or bonus or whatever, even though he's been working very hard and, as far as he's concerned, very effectively, hasn't had any sort of feedback to say that he hasn't been delivering, will he ultimately become disengaged and demoralised?
I think we probably all intuitively know the answer, don't we? It's, you know, I'd say it's more than a danger, it's almost a certain byproduct, you know, that where we create upward pressure in organisations of that nature, and you create ranking systems, and people are, who, you know, perceive themselves at one level, land somewhere else repeatedly, they will be demoralised. But it's back to that point I made before, that these are dehumanising and demoralising processes. They're not deliberately that way, but it is the consequence of the way that we approach many of these structures. So, and I will give you, but I will give you an example where, way, way earlier in my career, so in that run I was describing where things were going particularly well, I reached, I was 31 years old, maybe 32, but and the second tier down in this sort of global organisation, and so and then they have a process that they run which is about acceptance into the top tier. And I got a tap on the shoulder, said, you know, you're going into a process, and there were about 150 of us. The next day, half of that group got a tap on the shoulder and said, you didn't make it. You weren't involved in that process. So there's 75 people who are the top performing of the next level down your firm. They got a tap on the shoulder and said, you didn't make it. So they got demoralized without being included in a process. I, at this point, said, I actually don't want to be, you know, I don't think I'm quite ready and I shouldn't be in this process. I was a bit young, was quite a lot younger than anybody else, and was feeling probably at my limit at the time. And anyway, but I go into this process. At somebody much more senior, sort of insistence, really. And then we go through debates in front of global leadership, presentations, you know, training programs, all this sort of stuff. And then you come out the other end and you get ranked. And the top 12 got promoted. And the next batch, and people were getting whittled away all the time. Mm. And I think I came 20th. Of the last 25, you know, left in the process. And I went round and they, you know, said, you go and meet everybody. And then actually, you look at your score on every individual piece, and they said, well, you scored really well. You were first in this, you were second in that, you were fourth in that, you were fifth in that. But how did I end up 20th? They said, well, actually, we just decided you were too young and you'd probably come back next year. And I can promise you, I've never been so deeply demoralised in my life. I left that firm within 6 months. Mm. And, you know, just in pursuing that, there is an example of, you know, again, the crazy process. And that, maybe you could argue that in that sort of environment, it's about weeding out people who aren't entirely committed, but I probably was until that point, you know. So, yes. You had another question?
Yeah, one of the companies I work for transferred a different approach to the performance reviews again. They took the money aspect of it completely out of the process. So the performance review is all about your training for the next year, how well you did in the last year, what you want to achieve, how you can be engaged with the company. And if a promotion was available, that was discussed or coming up. But the money aspect, the pay rise aspect, was taken out. And what happened was the company said, we're going to blanket pay rise. So we're going to give this much money to the employees divided by how many employees we've got. Bang. So it wasn't down to this person gets a 5% pay rise, this person gets 3%. It was a percentage, it was based on your salary. So you might get more money than somebody else because you're on a higher salary, which is performance given anyway. But it did help take away the demoralising aspect of the performance review and made it personal to each individual
entity. Yeah,
do you think that was a good idea and a good approach?
Yeah, I'll just, again, I'll...
Yeah, sorry.
Just, no, that's right, that's fine. Yeah, just repeat, just so one of the companies you worked for took the pay element out of the performance review process and gave everybody a blanket fixed percentage increase, and the performance review was solely around performance issues, development ideas for the future and that sort of thing. And your feeling was that seemed to work a lot more effectively, more satisfyingly perhaps for the employees. Yeah. And the question was, do we think it's a good
idea? Listen, it sounds like a great idea. You know, some observations might be that why leave it as an annual review? You know, why isn't that happening more frequently? You know, monthly, quarterly? You know, that we develop at different speeds, and you know, that more frequent conversation makes it more natural than a look back over a whole year and look forward to a whole year forward. So, but I think stripping out reward in that way and playing blank, it sounds like a better process than perhaps some others. But I would say some other things associated, and that's that, you know, we need to think about the implications of those things too. So, you know, if when we apply blanket, this is the challenge with rules, isn't it? But when we apply a blanket pay rise, that is, just for everybody, then, and unless you have addressed some of the other things in your culture, so that we deal with underperformance properly, that we develop people appropriately, that we create teams that genuinely function like teams, and that people in them are, you know, operating in the proper meritocracy, then, you know, you risk demoralising in some other ways. So, you know, this is about, it's simply about human beings and how we function in groups, isn't it? So, so back to the question. Yes, I think it sounds like a great idea, as long as it's wrapped with some other things.
When it was announced,
I'm going to have to cut us short here, as our room is something else. So we've hit 2 o'clock here. So it's a fantastic session. So it was a good sign. We run it. We really do run out of time. So it's been an excellent session. So I'd like to thank David for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody here for contributing to the discussion.
For more information, visit radiolab.beds.ac.uk/businessmatters.